We have just recently celebrated the 400th death anniversary of the late, great William Shakespeare. Many of you might have read the fantastic obituary of Shakespeare that the New York Times published on its front page. I'm sitting here with the author of that obituary, Lewis Byard.
Correct.
Who has just told me how to pronounce his name, so I feel very proud.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 496, novelist Lewis Byard.
I became familiar with Lou's work, I don't even know how many years ago it was now, but I came across a novel.
Was it 10 years?
10 years ago, sort of the mid-2000 and aughts, when I read Lou's novel, Mr. Timothy, which is a kind of sequel to A Christmas Carol, imagining a grown-up Tiny Tim. And it was wonderful, and it was exactly the kind of literature that I'm just a fanatic for. This, I don't know, how would you describe it? A historical mashup? Literary fanfic?
perversely dark homage to Dickens. It's
perversely dark is right, because it changed genres. It's no longer... Dickens is pretty dark, but you made it a real thriller.
Yeah, it's a mystery thriller, and it's... It basically came out of me wanting to do bad things to Tiny Tim,
because I even more bad things.
Because I never liked him. That was my guilty secret. I never liked Tiny Tim. Loved Dickens.
Right.
Loved Dickens. Couldn't stand Tiny Tim. The whole God bless us everyone just pissed me off every time I heard it. So I thought, what can we do to this child? And so we grow him up and we take away the crutch. You know, he's fine now. He can walk. We take away all these sources of easy sentimentality and familiarity, and then we turn him inside out. So in the book Mr. Timothy, he's in living in a brothel, teaching the madam how to read. He's by night dredging the River Thames for dead bodies with his friend Golly, and then he gets involved in this mystery surrounding these dead girls that keep popping up in the streets of London. So it goes from there, but it is a Christmas story of a sort. It takes place around Christmas, and I hope it's true in some sense to the original story.
Oh, and it's 100%. It is in it, Phil. I've recommended it to many people, and it feels absolutely of a piece. And yet, you say you claim to have hate the character, and yet as your protagonist, you've made him sympathetic and lovely.
Yeah, that was my idea. That was my idea, to kind of put him under a different kind of duress than Dickens did, and see what happened to him at the end. And yes, but by the in the book, he becomes somebody I'm quite fond of. I was sorry to see him go.
And are all of your novels dark literary homages?
They are, pretty much. They're, people know me because I'm a fairly, you know this about me already, I'm a fairly affable person.
Unlike many writers, you can hold up your end of a conversation.
so I must be, because I get it out on the page, because friends will, can I swear on this?
Yeah.
Okay. Friends will read my books and it's like, where does this shit come from? You know, what is going on here? It's like, I don't know, but better out than in, as Austin, no, who said that? Shrek.
Shrek, Jane Austen.
I get them confused so frequently. or you, Austin. Yeah, I said it was Austin Powers.
Oh, that one.
That was right. I was going with Mike Myers. I lost the thread. But yeah, they do tend to turn out to... There's a book called The Pale Blue Eye, which is about Edgar Allan Poe when he was a cadet at West Point, and there are bodies turning up with hearts missing. It's very, very Poe-based, with the title itself comes from the Telltale Heart.
Right.
And then there's a book called The Black Tower, which is about Vidocq, who was a real-life French detective from the early 1800s. The basis for Javert and Jean Valjean, both in Les Misérables.
Wow. And you also have a book, is it your most recent, Roosevelt's Beast?
Roosevelt's Beast, which is about Teddy Roosevelt in the Brazilian jungle. Lifting off of what really happened, he actually took this Fakakta expedition, down this uncharted river called the River of Doubt, because nobody knew where it went, and nearly died. And so the actual story is fascinating, but then I kind of build a sort of horror story on top of that involving a beast, an actual beast. Yes.
cool.
Yeah.
Well, and I have spoken to Christopher Moore, novelist Christopher Moore, on the podcast about his Serpent of Venice.
Oh,
which imagines Merchant of Venice combined with Othello, combined with Edgar Allan Poe, and a monster.
I love it. Yeah. We're just mashing it all up together.
So it seems like we travel in sort of the same fields a little bit. Sort of imagined riffs on established either literary or historical figures. What is it about it that fascinates you?
That's a really good question. I guess because every writer begins as a reader, and you develop these loves. They're kind of like your first loves, and Dickens was one, and Shakespeare was one, and so it's fun to play with that. Yeah. and investigate these amazing writers who were the reason you became a writer in the first place.
Right.
And there's a long tradition of that. Shakespeare, as you know, I don't think he did an original plot, did he? Maybe The Tempest,
yes.
But most of his stuff is recycled from other stuff and improved almost in almost every case.
Yeah.
But he had no problem taking an old story and just rejiggering it and making it something that would be interesting.
I can take this and use it.
Yes,
use these bones.
The raw material, yeah.
Make soup out of this carcass.
That is an excellent metaphor. Well done.
And how did you become a novelist? I mean, it's not just a novelist, a successful novelist.
Oh, well, thank you. Because I wasn't fit to do anything else, really.
Okay.
I mean, it's probably how you feel about acting.
Yeah.
There's nothing else I'm really fit to do that society would want me to do. I was always a writer and an actor in college, but writing is the one thing I couldn't imagine not doing. I couldn't imagine my life without that.
Interesting.
I could imagine everything else going away, but not that. And so I just kind of stuck at it. And it's almost a proof of your vocation. This is probably true of actors, too, is that you keep doing it even when the world itself doesn't particularly care if you're doing it.
You're doing it for the love of it.
Yeah,
yeah.
You're doing it for the love, but at some point it's nice if somebody pays you to do it. So that eventually happened, yeah.
And at some point you found an agent or an editor? What was that path?
My path was unorthodox. I couldn't find an agent at first, so my first two books were published by a small press out in L.A. Actually, they were overlooking the fields of Hollywood High and across the street from Grumman Chinese Theater. I don't think they're there anymore. Anyway, but they were a legitimate press. But actually, when I got the Mr. Timothy idea, I thought, you know what? I want this to be published by a big New York house. So I finally found an agent who kind of liked the idea, and we wrote it. I wrote it on spec, sold it to the first person it was pitched to.
Which was St. Martin's, yeah?
It was HarperCollins.
HarperCollins, okay.
HarperCollins. And found my editor, who I did the next four or five books with, and it was
fantastic.
Yeah, it was, but so much of this is luck, too, as you know. It's like if I hadn't found, because it was pitched to a bunch of other people, and she was the only editor who sort of bit.
Interesting.
Did
your degree is in journalism.
I have a master's in journalism. And then an undergraduate English, but a creative writing thesis. I wrote a book of short stories for my senior thesis. And actually, my advisor was Joyce Carlos, with whom I'm still somewhat in touch. I cannot match her for output. She is.
Oh my God! Yeah, she has. I think she had just had a book published since we started this interview.
Exactly. She just. Yeah.
It's funny. You mentioned Joyce Carol Oates because I think I've read maybe one or two of her books, not many, and I tend to think of them as domestic novels, which is probably unfair. But one of the reasons I like your books and Chris Moore's books and Jasper Ford's books is that I like these fan fiction, whatever they turn dark homages, because for me there's a starting point. I guess I'm not interested in a domestic drama, but unless if you tell me it's based on King Lear, then suddenly I am interested in A Thousand Acres by Jane Smiley.
That's interesting.
Do you know what I mean?
So you need a point of reference to kind of get into it.
But getting back to your training, because I know a bunch of novelists who are only would-be novelists at this point. They've written them, but they haven't published them because they haven't had that break. They haven't found that lucky break. But the degree in English, degrees in journalism can't have hurt.
They can't have hurt, but I know a lot of people who who have the same credentials and just for whatever reason haven't broken through. I mean, there are a lot of places now to get published in the short form. Internet has, there are lots of internet magazines and stuff like that, but it's harder than ever, I think, to break it into publishing, and I think harder than ever to be a first novel published. It's really hard these days.
This is Christopher Moore, the author of Fool and the Serpent of Venice, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? On June 24th, 2016, we'll perform The Complete History of Comedy Abridged at the People's Bank Theater in Marietta, Ohio. Then on July 7th and 8th, we'll perform William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at Appalachian State in Boone, North Carolina. For the entire month of August, we'll perform William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in August. We'll be at the Pleasance again. We're looking forward to it. And we have a bunch of performance dates this fall of 2016, all over the United States. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information.
And you continue to be a journalist. I mean, you're right?
Kind of a sort of journalist.
Yeah. Essayist, maybe?
Yeah, kind of. Or I do... I don't know what to call myself. Maybe essayist, but that sounds fancy for what I do. One of the things I did that was kind of popular, I recapped Downton Abbey for the New York Times. And it was a strange sort of gig.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember reading them, yes.
Yeah. It was strange. It was one of those things that I just decided to go all snark on the show. Because it's a silly show, right?
Yeah.
And what I learned about the fans is they were ready to go with me. They were not pious about that show. You watched the show?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
They were not precious, yeah.
Oh, God, no. Yeah. I suppose to say, like, Mad Men fans who would not suffer a single joke about their favorite show. But,
right.
But the Downton Abbey fans, they'll roll with whatever you got. And then all they want to know is, like, okay, what did Maggie Smith say? And what was Lady Mary wearing and stuff like that. So I don't know if this counts as journalism. I think of journalism as... you know, taking down President Nixon. But maybe that's a narrow definition.
Well, it's a broad tent, as the GOP like to use to say. How did you get the commission how did you come to write the obituary for William Shakespeare on April 23rd?
They called me.
Oh, awesome. That's a great gig.
I know. That's the thing. If people didn't call me, things wouldn't happen nearly as much as they do. They called me for Downton Abbey, and they called me for this. And it was the hard part was not so much the research, although that was considerable, and I spent some time at the Folger, where you're spending every night of the week. Mm-hmm. But trying to get the right tone and trying to figure out if it was going to be an obituary from 2016 or an obituary from 1616.
Yeah.
And I just thought it'd be funnier to write it as though it were happening on the day of Shakespeare's death, but with little winks about what happened thereafter. And one of the things we discovered... is that Shakespeare was not even considered the prime writer of his own age.
Yeah.
He was considered, at best on the same level maybe as Beaumont and Fletcher and Ben Jonson. There was no consensus that he was the soul of his age. and that took another century, really, before that cult of Shakespeare kind of finally kicked in. And so that was kind of interesting. And then, of course, half of the plays hadn't been published by the time he's dead.
Right.
So you had to kind of figure out, is it seven? Hemming and Cordell?
Hemming and Condell, yeah.
Condell, yeah. The ones who put together the first folio. That would take another 7 years,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, 1623.
So it makes you aware of the contingency of literary history. If those guys hadn't done that...
Well, yeah, and he did... I have not. We've done a fleet of podcasts relating to Shakespeare, obviously, this year, particularly given our trip to the Folger. But I've not yet spoken to a anti-Stratfordian. You know, somebody who believes that anybody else other than William Shakespeare wrote the plays. But it's one of the plot threads of Jasper Ford's Air Affair, too, is that this running commentary of... it's illegal to even think in his world that somebody else wrote the plays. But William Shakespeare, the man from Stratford, left money in his will to the Shakespeare from London's colleagues, Hemming and Condell. if Shakespeare, the man from Stratford, wasn't related to, why would he have done that? You know, for instance, is one of the many bits of evidence.
And so many bits of evidence. It drives, actually drives me crazy.
And logic. and yet I wonder if there was some unspoken thing from Shakespeare saying, oh, God, in a John, Henry, in about 7 years, could you maybe publish the plays?
I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. Why did they go? Because they went to enormous expense and labor to do that.
Yeah, and I don't think he left him that much money in his will.
No, I don't think he did.
But this is another great historical what if, isn't it? Could some novelist could come along and figure out and write that story.
Yeah, because if they hadn't, we wouldn't have Macbeth, I don't think, or Othello, or The Tempest, or a bunch of them. And even the ones that survived were in very imperfect versions. So they're the heroes of English literature in some sense. They're the ones who made it happen. And I think that helped it for Shakespeare's reputation, the fact that his work did survive intact in a way that maybe a lot of his peers didn't. Even I guess there are a couple missing plays.
Still, the Cardenio. We talk about in our play the story of Merlin as a possibility. Love's Labour's One, that's in there. But then he did, of course, write The Lion King, so that's all good. Do you have a routine, a regimen you stick to as a writer?
I do. I try to. I try to spend at least, because I have lots of balls in the air. I teach a class at George Washington, or I did. And I have various projects, journalistic stuff. I do a lot of book reviewing. But I try to set the first hour of every day aside for fiction, because that hour that hour becomes sacred. As you know, if you put anything off to mid-afternoon, whether it's going to the gym or whatever, that gets so easy to get lost.
I'm flattered that you think I go to the gym, but thank you.
You have a ruddy glow about you.
Oh, that's what it is.
That's what it is.
I'm about to have a heart attack. I think that's what that is.
So I try to do at least the first hour of every day. I spend a lot of time in coffee houses, like the one we're sitting in currently.
But just an hour.
Ideally more. Okay. Ideally more. If I can get a whole day, that's wonderful. Yeah. But it's rare. It's fairly rare. Plus, I have kids. I have to pick up and take to school, and it's very hard to get a long, long chunk of time to do anything.
I know that I don't have a regimen like that. I do know that I write best in the morning. I do know that I learn lines best in the morning.
Interesting.
But when we're writing a new script, it's basically clear the decks. I just sit at my computer and only get up to pee or eat or kiss the wife and pick up the kids if I have to. Yeah. But yeah, it's just, fortunately they're old enough now where I can just.
You're an empty nester now, right?
Yeah. How old are your kids?
15 and 13.
Oh, you're getting there.
Yeah, except I think they'll live forever. I think my 13-year-old, I actually think he's going to die in that house. I don't know who will own it.
But he's not leaving.
He's not leaving.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Pick up one of Lou Byard's novels now. You'll be glad you did. And you can follow him on Twitter at Louis Byard. Then send us your snarky recaps via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks as always to webmaster Matt Rippey, not terribly novelist Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout out this week goes to Brian Cotter. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Christopher Moore, author of Fool, The Serpent of Venice, and Lamb, The Gospel According to Biff, Christ's Childhood Pal. You can follow Chris on Twitter at TheAuthorGuy. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 496 1488ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. I feel embarrassed that I've only read Mr. Timothy, but now I have to, because and now that I mostly know my lines for William Shakespeare's long lost first play, I could start reading fiction again. I really put all the reading aside, but I'm going to delve into your entire oeuvre, if I'm allowed to say that.
Yeah, you can say canon. You can say canon too.
You have a mighty canon.
Wait, that came out wrong too.
Wait a second.
I don't know where this is going.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.